this sober mind, intoxicated tongue, with this smooth talk, hot like the sun. Hitting the interviews, yeah, we doing a thing, cause I guess keep it lit straight on the scene. Whether it's stories, hobbies, or just the job in life, best believe we spark it off and do it right. So stay tuned, cause we about to take flight, take it a new height, yeah, this that podcast.
All right, thank you so much, everybody, for joining me. My name is Ricardo. You are listening to the Sober Mind Intoxicated Tongue podcast. Today we have a special guest. He goes by the name of Peter Moore. He was locked hostage for about 2.5 years, and we're going to hear a little bit of a story. So, Peter, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no, thanks for the invitation. I went to school in a place called Lincoln in England, which is one of the small cities here. And I went and did a degree in information technology, a bachelor's degree. And then I subsequently went on to do a master's degree in computer science. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time that I learned that I could work in international development doing computing. So after my master's degree, I looked into that kind of work. And my first job was working in China for a couple of years at a university.
Oh, wow.
And I enjoyed it. And I then came back to England in my mind with the intention of settling down and doing that sort of, you know, 9-to-5 kind of job. And I very quickly got bored with that.
Oh, wow.
So I looked for other work overseas. And I initially was offered a place with an organization called Voluntary Services Overseas, or VSO. That's like the British version of the Peace Corps America.
Okay.
And they offered me a 2-year placement in Guyana in South America, you know, Jim Jones and all that sort of thing. I went there for a couple of years, and I was developing databases to deal with land management. So Guyana is part of it's 90% Amazon rainforest.
Wow.
So I was part of the department that was mapping the land. So I was able to travel around the Amazon, and I developed computerized maps. It's called GIS, Geographical Information Systems. And I did the back end database for it.
Oh, wow.
Stayed on for a third year, and this was took me up to 2007 now.
So how I don't mean to interrupt, how old were you at this time?
At that time I was 32.
Okay.
So 32. And I realized that volunteering, while good for the soul, is not good for the bank account, and that I really needed to get a job. So I looked for other work internationally, and I cut a long story short, a company called Bearing Point contacted me and said that they needed somebody to go to Iraq to work on the Ministry of Finance database because it wasn't working and they couldn't produce reports off of it. So I thought about it. I knew it was dangerous in 2007. But I was only supposed to be there for 3 months, so I decided to do it. I'd have a security team. In my mind, what could possibly go wrong? So I packed my bags and I flew from Guyana via Washington DC to Iraq, Baghdad, Iraq.
Oh, wow.
And I arrived in Iraq on the 2nd of April 2007. That's when the plane landed, and I remember getting off the plane, and as I was walking along sort of towards the building, the airport, from the runway, I saw this like kind of missile land on the edge of the runway, and there was like this boom, and then this plume of smoke came up in the distance.
Oh, wow. So this was kind of like welcome to Afghanistan.
Welcome to Iraq.
All right. Iraq, I'm sorry. Wow.
So, yeah. I arrived at the airport. We went through immigration. There was some issue with our paperwork, but we had someone from the company meeting us there, so that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And we were picked up by a security team, and they drove us to the compound that we were living in, and it was interesting, shall we say, the compound. So there was like walls of sandbags everywhere.
Okay.
And every so often, like multiple times a day, missiles would fly in, and you'd hear these sirens going and all this sort of thing. You had to like take cover in a what's called a duck and cover shelter.
Oh, okay.
Wow. It's like a little concrete kind of hut sort of thing. So I was quite surprised
by
how volatile it was. I thought it wouldn't be as bad as that.
Now, was that that was your first day? Like, you're starting to get Wow.
Yeah. So I couldn't go anywhere because I didn't have my ID badge. I needed to have a permit to get through security checkpoints. So for the first couple of weeks, I actually couldn't go anywhere. I was stuck in what they called the green zone, which was supposedly the safe bit.
Okay.
But when I did get my permits, I would travel to the Ministry of Finance with a security team, two vehicles, and four security guards. And
was that just only you that was traveling to that building, or was there other co-workers as well? So
there was myself and two security guards in one vehicle, and in the other vehicle was another contractor who was a finance guy. And he had two of the security team with him as well.
Okay.
And they used what are called low profile vehicles. So they look like normal vehicles, but actually they're armored vehicles. They're armor protected, armor plated. And to be honest, I enjoyed being in the Ministry of Finance. It was in the red zone, but it wasn't really targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on well with the Iraqi team. You know, I was working with Iraqi programmers. And although my job was to develop the reports for this system, I realized that it would be better to train the Iraqi programmers to develop their own reports. And they seemed to be quite into that idea. So it was working well. You know, I actually felt safer in the red zone than I did in the green zone.
So why do you think that they didn't target the building?
I think it was just a government building of many that was in the red zone. Bearing in mind, it was full of Iraqis as well. So, you know, they weren't really targeting Iraqis at that point. They were targeting foreigners more.
Oh, okay.
You know, at the time when I arrived in Iraq, the event called the insurgency was going on. And the insurgency...
I'm sorry, you're cutting off a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so at the time when I arrived in Iraq, there was an event called the insurgency.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was all these militias had started fighting the American occupation of Iraq. And so America had brought in a whole load of extra troops to counteract this insurgency. So the fight at the time, I think, was more against foreigners than Iraqis.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's why they didn't really target that building. So, yeah, I'd been in Iraq, about a month and a half, something like that. And I'd got my permits. I'd been going to the red zone three times a week. I'd been doing training courses, all this sort of stuff. And on the 29th of May, 2007, at about 11 a.m., I was running a training course with these Iraqi programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I heard someone shout, "Get down." And... all in my room, everyone stood up. So I also stood up. Unfortunately, when I stood up, it put me right next to the door. So the next thing that I saw was the door opened, and there was a police officer from the Iraqi Ministry of Interior there.
Okay.
And he looked at me, I look at him, he looks at me, he puts a gun to my head.
Oh, wow.
I think I laughed, and I put my hands up. And with that, he said, "Come on." And he led me outside, and I thought, well, I'll see my British guards, you know, my four British guards. And they were nowhere to be seen. There was just loads of Iraqi police officers all over the place. I get led out towards the entrance of the Ministry of Finance, and I see two of my security guards there. And I said to him, "What do I do?" And they said, "Just do whatever they say." And I remember thinking in my mind, this is not very good. Supposed to be like Jean-Claude Van Damme, save me, this sort of thing.
Right.
So I guess it's Hollywood, you know. So they then disarmed the guards, my guards disarmed, and they led us outside into these convoy of police vehicles. There must have been about 20 police vehicles.
Wow.
They put me in the back seat, and we drive off with lights and sirens going. And while we're driving along, I'm still not sure what's gone on. You know, I'm thinking maybe I'm still under arrest at this point. And
have
then
you,
they start. Yeah.
So have you ever had like a bad encounter with the Iraqi police though before then or no?
No, never had any encounter with them at all up until that point.
Oh, wow.
So that was my first time. So yeah, as we're driving along, they start to take my clothes off. And I thought that's a bit weird.
Right.
And I remember in my pocket, I had something like $200. I was paying some expenses to the Iraqi programmers for some reason. I can't remember why. Mm-hmm. And I remember giving the $200 to this Iraqi police officer in the vehicle, because when I was in Guyana in South America,
right.
$200 will get you out of anything with the police, you know?
Right.
And I remember they looked at the money and threw it out of the window. And wow. I just thought, this is an abduction. You know, this right. is not right. You know, even by corrupt police standards, that shouldn't have happened, you know?
So that's when that really hit you, that it was a little bit more serious than your average...
Yeah, it was a little bit more than a corrupt police officer sort of thing. And I remember I was wearing steel toe cap boots and they took those off and threw them out the window. I remember thinking, I hope that doesn't hit anyone. That's really going to hurt.
That's funny. No, yeah. I was kind of laughing. I mean, it's kind of a funny thing to think about during such a, I guess, traumatic situation.
Well, you know, it's just a weird thing you thought about, you know?
Right, right.
And we only drove for about 15, 20 minutes, and they had the sirens going, and they fired the machine guns as they drove along, and that got them through checkpoints without being stopped.
Oh, wow.
Eventually, we stop in this area of Baghdad, a slum area of Baghdad called Sadar City, and they transfer me out of the police vehicle into the back of, like, this van sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the four British guards are thrown into the back. Now, actually, I'm okay at this point. I'm in my underpants, but that's it. My four British guards are all handcuffed and their hands are bound in various states. A couple of them have been hit in the head. There's blood on one of the forehead of one of the guards.
Oh, wow.
And they're thrown in the back. And then two Iraqis jump in and we drive off. And I remember looking at one of the Iraqis, and I sort of recognized him. I think he was the brother of one of the programmers I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him, I said, do you speak English? And he said, no. So, yeah. And with that, we drove on for maybe another 10 minutes. The British guards were taken out of the vehicle and led upstairs to a building. I was then taken out of the vehicle. And I could see the British guards sitting against the wall. They were now blindfolded at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have my hands bound. I wasn't blindfolded. I still had my glasses on, in fact.
So why do you think that they make you take off all your clothes pretty much?
Yeah, so I asked them that after, you know, a few weeks after we got captured. What they said was that they got rid of the clothes because they were concerned we had trackers in our clothes.
Oh, okay.
Which, I mean, you know, I'm a programmer. You know, I don't even know if such technology existed back then, but if it did, they wouldn't have given it to just a programmer. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, yeah, I'm assuming that they've done this before, so maybe they've definitely had that situation arise.
Yeah, indeed. So there was a bit of a build-up. There's a bit of a backstory to our abduction that I later found out after I got released. Before we got captured in March of 2007. Some Iraqi militia, four of them, I think, dressed up in American military uniform and walked onto an American military base and captured some American soldiers.
Oh, wow.
And drove off with them. But they were seen. And the Americans gave chase. There was a big shootout. Everyone got killed. The Americans they captured got killed, and the militia got killed also.
Wow.
A few weeks later, down in Basra, which is in southern Iraq, the British Army now are looking for the head of this militia, and they storm into a house and they capture someone called Qais al-Kasali and Laith al-Kasali, who's his brother,
mm-hmm.
and a Lebanese Hezbollah operative called Dak Durk, and a couple of other sort of people.
Right.
And then a month later, we come into Iraq, we're in the Ministry of Finance, and then we get taken by this militia. So there's a bit of a tit-for-tat thing going on. Oh,
okay, okay.
And subsequently, after we got captured, the militia actually captured some Americans as well, like five American security contractors as well. Which they killed them as well. I never met them, but you know, I learned more about this after I got out, to be honest with you. I didn't know what was going on. I forgot where we were. What do you want? Ask me a question.
Yeah, you were going, you had gotten out of the vehicle, you're still in your trousers.
Oh, that's right. So yeah, I was in my underpants. I don't know what Americans call them. Boxer shorts, do you call them?
I just call them underwear.
Okay, there you go. Right. Underwear. I'm led upstairs. I'm in my underwear. I've still got my socks on, and I've got my glasses on, and my hands are not bound. Mm-hmm. But I can see the four British guards are all handcuffed now. They're blindfolded. They're sat next to the wall. And they sit me down on the opposite wall to the British guards. And then they pull my socks off, take my glasses off, throw those away.
Oh, wow.
Then they lead me out of the building, blindfold me, and they bind my hands together with cloth and then put me in a vehicle and drive me around and then just take me back into the same room again because I can hear the British guards talking to each other. So I don't quite know what that was about.
Were they trying to confuse you or make you think that you were actually somewhere else or what?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was the general plan. I think they just wanted to blindfold me so that I didn't see anything.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bit of a discussion going on with the British guards about, are they going to kill us? What's going on? All this sort of stuff. And they lead one of the British guards out. And I remember this British guard had been injured. I thought he broke his shoulder, but actually that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. And I hear him being led out and he's in pain. You know, he's like, ow, ooh, ow, all this sort of stuff. And then there's a gunshot.
Oh, wow.
And there's a huge debate amongst the British guards. Have they just killed this guy and all this sort of stuff? And I'm thinking, I don't know. Have they killed him? What does this mean? You know. Right. And then with that, they pick me up and lead me out of the building. I'm walking halfway down the stairs and then there's a gunshot. You know, obviously it was a scare tactic.
Oh, okay.
It worked. I was scared. And they put me in another vehicle. Like the backseat of a car, and we drove around for maybe only 10 minutes, something like that, led me out of this vehicle and walked me into this like basement of like a farmhouse or something. And then I heard the British guards walking in as well. They were talking. So I knew we was all still together at this point. And we were there for like half an hour, probably even longer, maybe an hour. And they gave us cake and some water to drink, which I thought was a bit weird.
That is really weird.
Yeah. And then they led me out and they kind of made me climb into the back of like this big truck that had a cover over it. But the truck had like a ledge on the back of it. And obviously I couldn't see, mm-hmm. Right? I'm blindfolded. So they kind of threw me over this ledge and I land, I don't know, probably 3 feet lower on the base of the truck, on the inside of it. And I hear this huge crack on my ribs and then this huge pain. So obviously I broke my ribs.
Oh, man.
And then they lead me into this false compartment behind the driver's cab of this truck. And they put my back against the wall. I've got my knees up to my chest. They then bring another British person in with his back on my knees. And then there was a third British person brought in with his back against the other side of the truck. And then they sealed up this false compartment and we drove off. And it was really narrow. I remember it was less than my shoulders width narrow. It was very, very cramped.
Oh, wow.
And I got a bit brave at this point while we were driving along. So I kind of carefully lifted up my blindfold and you know, I couldn't see very much, but there was like cracks in the weld. So I could see sunlight through it and I could see that we were trundling along a road or something. And I remember trying to find a way out of it. And there was just no way out at all. And I just remember thinking, this would never happen to Indiana Jones. You know? He'd be out of this by now. And I just thought, this is incredible, you know. And my head, I remember my head was banging from side to side of this metal cab.
Now, I don't mean to interrupt or anything like that, but...
Oh, what?
I know you joke around with that, but is that actually what you were thinking during that time? You know, is that?
Yeah, I really thought that at that time. I just really thought, you know, what would Indiana Jones do?
Oh, wow.
Next? you know, and he would have got out of it, you know.
Right.
And all I can say about it is it's not like the movies, you know. It really isn't. I remember my head was banging from side to side on this metal cab. It was so narrow. So in the end, I just forcibly pushed my head to the right and leant on the metal side. And with that, I decided to try and fall asleep and rest because I couldn't do anything.
Right.
Eventually, I mean, we're in this truck for like a day or something. Eventually, the truck stops.
Oh, wow.
And I hear them sort of open the false compartment. We get some cake, we get some water. And then, you know, it was all sort of went a bit quiet. So I sort of lifted up my blindfold and I looked up and you could see the stars. Obviously, it had like a canvas cover on this truck. See, mm-hmm. the rolled back, and I could see the stars on it. And I remember tapping the British guy in front of me and saying, hey, you know, you can see the stars. And I lifted, he had his handcuffed behind his back. Mine were just bound at the front.
Oh, okay.
So I lifted his blindfold and said, look up, you can see the sky. And I remember that was the last time I saw the sky for over 2.5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, during this time, why do you think that they hurt the British guards and not you?
Well, the British guards were armed. So I think they were very quick to overpower them.
Okay.
So that's what happened. Not all the guards were injured. Two of them had been beaten up quite badly, and they were the ones that were outside, so they would have been the ones that were hit first. The two that were inside the building with me weren't too bad. You know, they were just handcuffed and things like that. The guy that I thought had got the broken shoulder, actually what had happened to him was they just put the handcuffs on really tight and it hurt his wrist.
Oh, okay.
So, so yeah, he was fine. It's probably worth saying as well, one of the guards that was outside was actually sat in one of the vehicles. So when the militia came in, there's a panic button inside the car, and they did hit that panic button. So my sensor in the green zone knew that something had gone wrong, but obviously they're, whatever, 15 minutes away, something like that.
Right.
So by the time they arrived on site, we were long gone.
Now, who was supposed to kind of help you guys if you guys got into trouble in that situation? Was it the American, the Americans, the British, your bit more British guards, or what?
Right. So there was obviously myself, and I had four British security guards on site. So they were the immediate security.
Mm-hmm.
If they pressed the panic button, that sounded an alarm back at our base, our compound, where we had something like 20 additional guards that would turn up to the location. And they did, but obviously it was too late.
Right.
But once we'd been abducted and it was effectively a crime, Baghdad at that time was under American jurisdiction. So it initially fell to the American military to sort of set up checkpoints and all that sort of thing. But by the time they'd done all that, we were long gone out of Baghdad.
Oh, wow.
So I remember a couple of days after we got taken, the militia let me watch the BBC news, and it was showing the Iraqi army setting up all these checkpoints trying to look for us. You know, we were nowhere near there. We were down in Basra. We were, whatever, 300 miles away at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a bit depressing.
Now, when you talk about militia, like the way I look at the militia is kind of like a pretty much a group of people that are not even in the military, but they're just kind of like your average citizen that kind of decide to band up together to fight against whatever they feel to fight against. Is that what that was?
Yeah, so correct. So these were a Shia militia. At that time, they were classed as a Shia militia. So a militia is like a private army, I guess, if you want to put mm-hmm, it that way. Yeah. Not as opposed to a terrorist organization, which is a little bit different. You know, they target all sorts of people, don't really worry about borders and that sort of thing.
Okay.
However, my group, which was called a Sib al Haq, or the League of Righteous, in January of this year, the Americans have now defined them as being a foreign terrorist organization. So they are now classed as a terrorist group.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, following the killing of Soleimani, you know, the Iranian Republican Guard leader.
No, I don't know that.
He was on the news.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
So the Americans killed the head of the Iranian
Okay, I think I know who you're talking about. They wanted to fight back because of that.
Yeah, okay. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So my militia was trained by Iran and funded by Iran and all that sort of thing.
Okay.
I mean, there have been books written about as being held in Iran, and while those books are great books to read, we were never in Iran. You know. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good story, but not true.
But not my story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So once you got there to that location where you would be held for 2.5 years, what was that like in the beginning? Like, when did it really settle in that you're not getting out?
Yeah, so I wasn't held in one location for 2.5 years. I was moved around every couple of months. So half of my time was spent in various locations in Basra, and the other half was spent in various locations in Baghdad. After we got out the truck and we was kind of put in houses and held and chained and all this sort of stuff, the four security guards were split into two groups of two. And for whatever reason, basically for the first 6 months, I kept being transferred between those two groups. So I knew we were all alive and I knew that we were very close together. The initial thought from my British guards was that dead or alive, this thing would be over in 6 months. Oh, you know, 6 months was a long time to be in Iraq. You know, we'd either be rescued, killed, or released.
Right,
you know?
Wow.
6 months came and went, and I remember in December of 2007, which is about 6.5 months at this point, they asked us to do a proof of life video. So they come in and they made us read a statement. Each one of us did this.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they chose one of the British guards on the news on CNN. And I remember watching this CNN news article, and it showed all the foreign hostages that had been captured in Iraq so far. And there was like, whatever, 10, something like that.
Right.
And then it greyed out all the ones that had been killed and it left two. And I just remember thinking, this is not going to look good. This is not going to end well.
Wow. You know? Now, at that point, were you, like, say you were, I guess, afraid? How afraid were you?
Well, I mean, truthfully, initially, the first few months, every time the windows rattled, I thought, oh, it's a rescue. It's the special forces coming to rescue me. You know, Delta or the SAS are coming in, right, or whatever. That never happened. So after that, I started to think, well, maybe we might get released. But after we hit that 6 month mark, I was like, no, we're just going to die. You know,
wow.
That's it. And I remember at about the 7 month mark, something like that, this police sergeant from the Ministry of Transport came in, and I got on well with these Iraqis, really. This particular guy was okay. But I don't know, maybe he was having a bad day at the office or something, because he came in and he took me off the chains and he handcuffed me behind my back and blindfolded me. And that's what they normally did when there was a move, when we was doing a move to a new location.
Mm-hmm.
But we normally did the moves at night. And on this time, it was like midday, which was a bit odd. Anyway, he took me outside and I was a bit like, what's going on, you know? And then he knelt me down and he put a pistol to my head.
Oh, shit.
And cocked the pistol. And I remember, you know, thinking, what's happening, sort of thing. And then he fired, and there was a bang. You know, what I didn't realize was they fired a gun off behind my back, you know.
Wow.
And I remember hearing the cartridge of the bullet, like, bounce on the concrete, you know, like, ding, 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 ding. And everything went black and white. And I just thought, I'm dead.
Wow.
You know, and it felt like minutes, but in reality, it was probably only seconds. But
right.
I just remember thinking, well, you know, that didn't hurt. And it has ended. You know, it's not ended how I wanted it to end, but it's okay, you know.
Right.
And then suddenly I heard people laughing. And slowly, you know, the blindfold was just like a a piece of cloth, yeah? Mm-hmm. So when you look down, you could see daylight through it a little bit. And I remember the black and white kind of started to disappear, and I saw sunlight come up through the bottom of it. I'm not very religious, but for that split second, I thought, I've made it. I've made it to heaven. And then like, no, hang on, hold on. No, don't be ridiculous. I'm still blindfolded. I can hear people laughing. Oh, I'm still handcuffed. You know, get a grip, sort of thing. You know?
Now, is that, you know, going through that, I guess, life-altering thing, would you say that you would have preferred to be dead at the time? Or was it you're still kind of relieved that you were alive?
You know, when I thought to myself I was dead and it's over, I actually felt quite calm and relaxed.
Right.
And then when I realized actually it wasn't, I was a bit like, you know, damn it. Okay, get a grip. You know, you're not dead. Get with it, sort of thing. Right? But what annoyed me about it was I always said if I was going to be executed, I wanted to show no fear. I wanted to show they'd not got to me. And I thought about it a lot because I thought this is going to end in death. So I need to be prepared for execution. You know, and I thought about my life and I thought about everything I've achieved, everything I'd done. I was content. I was happy with that, you know. But I wanted to have an image in my head of where I would be if I got executed, because potentially I could be there for eternity. And eternity is a long time, right?
Right.
So I had this image of walking the dog as a kid in the fields behind my house, you know, because that's what, in my mind, that's what I enjoyed doing.
Right.
But anyway, they took me outside, they put the gun to my head and they cocked it, and my mind went completely blank, and I started sweating, shaking, never experienced anything like it. And I was so annoyed that I let that get to me. I forgot about the image of walking the dog, all this stuff. Yeah, go on.
So you're more mad that you forgot about your happy place than...
Yeah, I completely forgot about it and just showed, you know, huge amounts of fear, you know.
Wow.
And what's funny about it is when I got out, I was talking to my stepdad about it. And I was saying, you know, I really enjoyed walking the dog as a kid. He said to me, Pete, you hated walking the dog. Never walked the dog. I was like, I don't remember it like that. Like,
I guess he just wanted that, I guess, what most people would want to have the last thought of, you know, like nice walking your dog or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I remember enjoying it, but still.
So, you said that during those 6 months, did you have any contact when you were able to watch CNN of that live, that, what is it called, that you're alive, whatever, the proof of life?
Proof of life.
Yeah, who did that go to? Did that go to, like, the other, the good people, just to make kind of like the whole, give us, you know, our people and we'll give him back or whatever? Is that what it was?
Yeah, no. So what they were telling us was that, you know, they wanted to use us for exchange to get their people released.
Right.
And up until that point, I really believed them. So they did this proof of life video that gets sent to the British Embassy some way. And then however they, you know, someone releases it to the press, right? However that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But the message that they had on CNN was that they wanted all foreign troops to withdraw within a week or something like that. And I just remember like, no,
wow.
That's not what they've been saying, you know, because, you know, that demand is definitely not going to be met.
Right.
Know, there's no way troops are going to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a bit like, you know, what does this mean? What's going on here? And they did explain to me that it was just, you know, something to say. But at the time, I didn't really believe it. I wasn't very sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember for that week, they were like, you know, if they don't withdraw within a week, we're going to execute these people. Wow. And I remember for that week thinking, this is it.
Now,
this is the end.
Have you ever heard the, I guess America has, or back in the day, I mean, I was still pretty young, but during George Bush's, I guess, presidency, I remember.
Yeah, that's right. So George Bush was the president at the time when we got captured, but then Obama became president in 2008.
Okay. But I remember specifically, at if I'm not mistaken, one of his models, I guess we don't negotiate with terrorists. Is that something I'd heard before or no?
Yeah, yeah. So the Americans have a very strict policy of non-negotiation with terrorists. Now, this is where things get a bit muddy. To start with, we weren't held by terrorists. We were held by militia, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the British government were involved. Now, the British government stance is non-substantive concessions.
Some big words.
Make of that whatever you will, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Plus, as well, we were civilians. So, technically, I had kidnap and ransom insurance, which would have paid for a negotiator.
Oh, but okay.
Because they wanted prisoner exchanges and because of the military occupation, it fell more to the military side to negotiate things. It was really, really complicated. The problem was we were British civilians being held by an Iraqi militia. The Iraqi militia were only dealing with the British embassy. However, Basra was under British military control and they were trying to negotiate for Iraqis to be released that were being held by the Americans.
Oh, wow.
So
it was a lot of content.
Straightforward at all.
Right, okay. So during this, the beginning of like your hostage, like what were you getting fed or if anything? Well, I mean, obviously you had to be fed something.
Right. So for the first sort of few months, we were being given sort of rice, some meat, that sort of thing. It wasn't very good quality sort of stuff. So this is where I started to try and get some concessions. The only Arabic food that I could think of was falafel. Mm-hmm. So I asked if we could have some falafel and the Iraqis were like, yeah, we can get you falafel instead. So I was like, to me, that said to me, oh, okay, you know, we might be able to get some concessions here. The problem was after that point for like the next 6 months, I was basically being fed falafel to the point that I hate falafel now.
Oh, wow. You know? that's fun, pretty funny.
Yeah. I also got pretty ill in the first year as well. I got like dysentery. The water was not very good.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually got a doctor in to come and see me. And he gave me medication. I mean, he was really quick, within 24 hours. But I was suffering badly. You know, I was chained to a grid in a wall with less than a meter of chain. Couldn't stand up, couldn't move. I had dysentery. You know, you're only allowed to go to the toilet once a day. Something's going to give, you know what I mean? It was really messy, you know, it was not good. But they got this doctor in, and the doctor gave me some medication, and it really worked, you know, it was really good. I was impressed, you know. I know America's healthcare system is, you know, sort of criticized a lot around the world.
Right.
But, you know, we have the National Health Service, which everyone says is brilliant, but you know, the Iraqi militia health service was absolutely outstanding.
So. Well, I'm assuming they had a big interest of you staying alive, at least for that, just to be able to negotiate, try and get their people out.
Sure. You know, when I look back now, it was obvious they weren't going to kill us. There were signs. It was clear they were not going to kill us. But at that time of being in it, I didn't realize that, you know.
So you were actually, you said you were chained to a wall. Like 24/7?
Yeah, yeah. So they had like a grill in the window,
mm-hmm.
and they spray painted the windows, and we were upstairs. And they had a chain that went around the grill, and then it went around one ankle, and they padlocked it around that ankle, and then put it around the other and padlocked it there. And then for the first 6 months, I was also handcuffed and blindfolded. So what they would do is they would undo the chain in the morning to let us go to the toilet,
mm-hmm.
and then walk us back and take the blindfold off in the toilet and then walk us back with the blindfold back on. And we'd sit like that all day. They'd take the blindfold off for us to allow us to eat. And that was about it.
So during this time, like, how do you not go crazy? I mean, just are you just sitting there or, you know, like obviously they're not going to let you watch TV or anything like that.
Not very rarely. Occasionally they would let us watch the news or some movie or something like that. But yeah, the blindfolding was weird because, you obviously you can't see if you've got a blindfold on, right? But obviously your other senses must get stronger, because you can sort of visualize when somebody walks past you, you know, you can sort of hear them and that sort of thing. It's very weird. It's very, very odd. It was a pretty harsh time. You were able to tell the difference between nighttime and daytime, because as I say, the blindfold was just like this cloth, so you could see out the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you was drinking, you'd tip your head back, you know, to drink more water, and you could sort of see a little bit.
Okay.
So yeah, that sort of thing.
Would you sleep a lot? Is that how you would pass time? Or I mean,
obviously... they wouldn't let us sleep during the day.
What?
So we were just sat there. But we was in the same room with the Iraqis. They had a TV in the room. Admittedly, it was Arabic TV, but you could tell whether it was a movie or the news or something like that. You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
I used to think about negotiating a motorcycle sale and walking the dog and, you know, interviews, that sort of thing, you know, random stuff, you know.
So can you talk to us about like the days leading up to your final release, or how that went down?
I think just roll it back a little bit. I'd been moved around a lot at this point, so every couple of months I've been moved around, and after about 8 months I got separated from the British people, and in early 2008 I was held with a couple of Americans, a guy called Sergeant El Tai, who was, it turns out, was the only American to be classified missing in action.
Oh, wow.
And a private security guard called Michael Chand, who was an ex-Marine that had got captured. He was a security guard. He came out of the Marines and became a security guard. And then I was with them for about 4 months. And then in early 2009, I'd been on my own for about a year at this point. I'd been moved up to Baghdad, and I'm watching the BBC News, and a picture of myself and my four guards comes on the news.
Oh, wow.
And it's in Arabic. It's BBC Arabic. And I'm not really sure what's going on. There's pictures of a couple of Iraqis. And I asked the Iraqi guards, I was like, what is this? And the Iraqi guard said to me, that bodies had been released by, you know, the British embassy had bodies handed over to them. And they're discussing who the bodies are.
Hmm.
And I said, well, no, it's not me. with that, I just sort of left it. About 2 weeks later, this guy turns up who was on the BBC News. A photo of him was on the BBC News. And he said to me, do you recognize me? I said, yeah, you were on the BBC. And he said to me, my name's Laith El-Kasali. He's the number two commander of this militia.
Oh, wow.
And he said to me, I've been released in exchange for two of your guards. I said, okay, you know, what does this mean? He said to me, you're the only one alive. Everyone is dead.
Wow.
They're all dead. I said, how did that happen? He said to me that they'd either died because they tried to escape or because they were in a room that they thought the Americans were raiding, but they got it wrong. The Americans were actually raided the house next door and the militia shot them.
Oh, wow. So,
and I was like, okay. And he said to me that as long as I don't try and escape and no rescue attempt is made, I'll be released when his brother gets released, a guy called Qais El-Kasali, the number one commander of the militia.
Now, at that time, did you believe him, or?
Not really. No. I thought they were going to kill me also. I thought I'd get released in exchange for his brother, but I thought they'd kill me first.
Right.
Because clearly they were prepared to exchange live Iraqis for dead people.
Right.
I now know that that's a Hezbollah trait. That's a Lebanese Hezbollah thing, to do body exchanges. In September of 2000, and where are we now? September 2009, they release 100 live militia for one dead body, one of my British guards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was like, whoever negotiated that needs to go back to negotiations.
Right. That's crazy. I mean, what is the point of actually releasing for, unless they didn't know that he was dead, but what's the point?
Well, I asked the British Embassy about it when it got released. I said, why did you negotiate the bodies out first? And they just said to me that that was policy.
Oh.
So I was like, okay. I don't know why. I don't know why they did that. Wow. So, yeah. And then I remember on the 29th of December, 2009, so one day before I'm released, I'm watching Arabic TV with my Iraqi guards. I should point out my conditions were pretty good at this point. I'm out of chains, I'm out of blindfolds, handcuffs, you know, I've got an ensuite shower, you know what I mean?
Oh, wow.
Things have improved a lot, right? And on the news, it was Arabic news, it was Baghdad news, but there was like this CCTV camera shot of this man getting out of a vehicle, like a 4x4 vehicle. It was clearly an Arabic man, a religious leader or something. And my militia got a little bit excited about this. And they said to me that that vehicle was Blackwater. Now, Blackwater was like this American private security firm that did these covert snatch and grab kind of operations for the American military. They had a really bad reputation.
Right. Yeah, and, I definitely heard of them.
Right, yeah, yeah. And I remember saying to my Iraqis, that's not Blackwater, that's diplomatic. And, you know, there was a bit of discussion about it, and I didn't think anything of it. So the next day, they come in at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and one of them gives me a kick, you know, says, wake up, get up, you know. I'm like, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, leave me alone, I'm going back to sleep. He says, no, get up, you got to get up, you're being released. So I said, why am I being released?
Wow.
He said, our leader's been handed over. You're going to go at 12 o'clock to the British Embassy. I was like, right, whatever. They'd told me constantly throughout my time I was being going to be released, so I just didn't believe them.
Okay.
And they brought in this other Iraqi that spoke better English.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, look, we've got you these new clothes. You need to go and have a shower. You need to get changed. You need to wear these clothes. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. You know. So I was like this stubborn teenager, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. What I thought had happened was maybe this militia had a fight with Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda had captured some of this militia, and they were exchanging me with Al-Qaeda. And that's what I thought maybe was going to happen.
Oh,
now, wow. At the time, I thought that would be good, because I knew I had kidnap and ransom insurance from my company.
Oh.
However, unbeknown to me, my company had actually gone bankrupt.
Oh my God.
I didn't know that.
So your policy just automatically just stopped?
Say that again, sorry.
So your policy automatically just stopped after that?
I would assume so, but I don't know. What actually happened was my division that I work for was bought out by Deloitte, and who's a big finance company.
Okay.
And I just always thought it'd be quite funny to have been in that meeting, that buyout meeting. You know, you just imagine the auditors saying, on your books, you've got 51 employees, but we can only account for 50. And they're saying, oh, yeah. Oh, we forgot to tell you about him. Yeah. Oh, sorry about that. You know. Yeah.
All right. That's funny.
Yeah. No, sorry.
No, that's our company, the where I work at, just got bought out about a year ago. So.
Oh, right. Okay. Nice. Have you still got a job?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, yeah. I do.
That's good. Don't get taken hostage.
I'm trying not to.
That's good. Actually, when I got out, somebody from Deloitte came to see me, and they said, you know, with your skills, we'd like you to go to Afghanistan. I said, with my skills, I'd be good at briefing people going to Afghanistan.
Right.
Anyway, you know, I have a shower, they give me these clothes. I do this release interview, which I've done before a ton of times. You know, they questioned me about being a military intelligence officer,
mm-hmm.
which I wasn't.
Right.
And they said to me, you're right, you're not a military intelligence officer. You're a very good military intelligence officer. I'm like, damn it. You know, they didn't get anything out of me because I didn't know anything. You know what I mean?
Now, well, did they try to get anything out of you during that time or no?
Not really. They did ask me some questions, but not like the interrogation that you see on the movies.
Right. Okay.
You know, they just randomly asked me questions. You know what I mean? Mainly about missiles and bases and things like that. I knew nothing. I had no idea what they were talking about, you know? And so, yeah, so with that, They lead me downstairs into the back seat of this car, and we drive off. And there's a guy in front, there's a driver and another guy in front with a camera. And the guy with the camera turns around and films me. And it's the very same guy that put the gun to my head and took me hostage from the Ministry of Finance.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, that's a nice touch. You know, the guy that took me hostage is about to either execute me or release me.
Right.
With that, we drive through the streets of Baghdad. We pull into this driveway. The vehicle stops. I get out. I walk into this room. And the room is full of people. Half of them are dressed in, like, you know, military gear, big machine guns, all that sort of stuff, scarves around their face. The other half are just dressed in normal clothes. There's cameras all over the place on tripods, people holding them. And then this room was quite long. And there was no furniture in it or anything, apart from at the end of this room, there was a sofa. And on it, there was a guy sat on it in a suit. And this guy got up and he said to me, "Are you Peter Moore?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "My name's Sami El Askari." I was like, "Okay, means nothing to me." He said, "I'm with the Iraqi government. You know, you're being handed over to us." And I just remember thinking, if you're with the Iraqi government, my situation has not improved. He makes a statement to camera. I'm asked to make a statement to camera. You know, what a great time I've had with the militia. I'll give them 5 stars on TripAdvisor, recommend it to anyone, that sort of thing. And with that, the guy in the suit walks out the room. I'm like, "Well, what do I do?" And this other Iraqi just says, "Go, go, go." I'm still not convinced I'm being released.
Mm.
And I'm walking out the room, and these two Iraqis in military gear stop me. They put their arms around me and they turn me around. And there's a guy stood probably about a meter in front of me with his hand behind his back. And I thought, this is it. You know, this is where it ends. They're going to execute me in this room right here, right now. With that, he pulls up his hand and he's got a camera and takes a photo. I mean, I guess it's for the Facebook page, right?
Exactly. It doesn't.
It's just bizarre.
It never happened if it was not on Facebook.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, it only just started, actually. It was in its infancy back then. But anyway, with that, I walk out the room. And I get into the back seat of this car, and I'm sat next to this Iraqi MP. And there's a couple of people in the front. They've got twirly things in their ear. Yeah, and we drive off. And I can hear this Iraqi MP on the phone. He's like, "Yeah, I'm with him now. We'll be there in half an hour, depending on the traffic, you know, doing it."
Right.
And he puts the phone down. And he says to me, "That was the British Embassy." And I just thought, if that was them, they'd want to talk to me, surely. Anyway, we're driving along, and I could see the doors unlocked. And I thought, maybe I could escape here. But I didn't want to jump out of the vehicle and get shot by the Iraqis following me.
Right.
So I thought, you know, just sweat it out. Let's see where this ends. We drive through these blast walls and then into this driveway. And I get out of the vehicle. Now, I don't know where I am. I don't know who these people are around me. But there's this one guy walking towards me. He looks completely out of place. He's wearing this bright pink shirt. You know, he can only be a British government official. You know what I mean?
Right.
Completely doesn't blend in, you know. You know, fish out of water.
Fish out.
And he walks up to me and says, "Hello, you know, I'm with the British Embassy. We're here to take you home." And I couldn't believe it.
Right.
And I just wanted to be on my own. And I always thought, at this point, when I get released, I'd have some great statement. You know, it'd be the name of the book, the movie, whatever. I couldn't think of anything. So the only place I could think of where I could be on my own was the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
So my opening statement was, "I need a pee." So it's like, yeah, toilet's there. So I go into the bathroom and I put my hands on the wall. And I start banging my head on the wall. And I'm like, you know, get a grip. You know, you're cracking up. You're going to hurt yourself, right? So
what were you doing that for?
Say again.
Sorry. So why were you doing that for?
I don't know. I think I was going crazy. I couldn't believe it was happening, really.
Oh, okay.
So I turn to the sink and I turn the tap on. I splash my face with water, and I look up at the wall, and it's just a wall of mirrors. And I just remember looking back at myself, thinking, "You've done it. You've beaten the odds. You've got out."
Right.
And I just started crying at that point. So.
Wow, that's intense. That's really intense. Now, during this during this time, did you ever have any contact with any of your family or anything like that, besides those videos that you would make?
Mainly through videos. I did receive one letter via the British Embassy from my step parents, but it was quite upsetting, so I told them not to give me any again.
Oh, wow.
But I did get another from a friend, and it was a postcard, and I remember she'd written it. It was so small to fit so much on, you know, it's really difficult to read. But she was someone I worked with as a volunteer in Guyana. She was another volunteer. I remember that. Yeah.
Oh wow.
But they were the only times. But I did see my step parents on the BBC and things like that a few times. That was fun.
So once you get released, obviously once they take you, obviously, do you go back to Britain right away or?
No, so I was released on the 30th of December 2009. So everything had shut down for New Year, Christmas holiday, New Year.
Wow.
So I spent, 2 days, 3 days even, I think, in the British Embassy in Baghdad. I just remember on that day of release, you know, I'm watching all the channels, CNN, BBC, everything. And it's like, you know, I'm there. I'm on the news. Every channel I've been released. I couldn't believe it. It was just bizarre, you know.
Wow.
And I remember the first thing I saw on the TV, on the news, on the BBC, they were doing like a review of the year, and it was a music review of the year. And I was like, what is this? And it was like Radio Gaga by Queen, you know? Do you know that song?
No.
You know, like, all we hear is Radio Gaga. Yeah, I don't know. Quite famous. By the band Queen, but it wasn't Radio Gaga. It was like Lady Gaga.
Oh yeah, I'll say that.
I'm like, what is this? You know, what am I watching? Sort of thing. You know, I was just like, this is really weird. And then breaking news came on. You know, and it was me. I was like, what? You know,
wow.
It's just weird.
Yeah. So once you get back to England,
yeah.
Did you have a lot of, or I say not just right away, but afterwards, did you have a lot of PTSD at all, or you know, kind of like?
No, so I had a military psychologist assigned to me. There was two American military psychologists looked after me in the British Embassy, and then a British naval psychologist was assigned to me for the few months when I was back in England, and they assessed me. I didn't have PTSD. You know, yes, I had stress through the event, but it wasn't really PTSD sort of thing. That what I was suffering from were classical signs of being a hostage,
right.
So they tell me. And I went into this debrief with like the counterterrorism police in the UK for like 30 days or something. You know, it was incredible. Apparently, wow. It was the longest they'd ever done, because it obviously formed part of a legal inquiry because people had been killed, right?
Right. Oh, wow.
And then, my life just went a bit weird after that. I ended up being interviewed by all sorts of people, including the Americans. Because obviously they wanted to know about the Americans that got killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was just a bit obscure, that first sort of few months. And as well, I'd been released back in the UK in the coldest winter in 20 years. which obviously for yourself, coming from Michigan, probably is nothing. But
right.
It was like really cold. You know, we had like 3 feet of snow. You know?
Wow.
And obviously, I'd been living in the tropics since 2004, right? So it was absolutely freezing. So after a couple of months, I actually went back to Guyana because I had a bank account there. My friends were there, you know, this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you say that your key thing of staying alive or staying mentally sane, what do you think that was during your 2.5 years?
Well, I think, principally, I didn't try and escape and no rescue attempt was made, so that helped.
Okay.
But tried to build a rapport with the Iraqis. I realized that my survival was dependent on getting on with them. So as much as I didn't like them, it was important to build a rapport, have conversations with them. I used to talk about their life, their religion, their family, that sort of thing. So I tried to put across that, you know, family first. I remember when we first got taken, they asked us all if we were married, and everyone said yes, they were married. So I said I was married also. So, you know, I had to ultimately base my wife on someone, you know, in my mind. this supermodel, but obviously that was unbelievable. Right. So I had to base it on something realistic. So I based it on a friend's ex-girlfriend, in fact, from Guyana. So someone called Emma. Her name was Emma, but I changed her last name to D'Souza because I thought that sounded Latin American, you know.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so kind of for 2.5 years, I had to hold up this, you know, fake wife story sort of thing. You know?
So you say you built some rapport with the Iraqi militia. Do you, were they pretty friendly once you started getting to know them, or did they accept? I didn't ever hear you say that they treated you in a bad way, like they never hit you or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, we had all that, especially in the first year. The militia fell into three kind of groups. There were what are called the non-ranks. So the ranks they had in the police force are the ranks that they had in the militia. So if you're a sergeant in the police force, you were a sergeant in the militia. So the non-ranks treated us pretty badly. They treated us how Hollywood would treat a hostage, if you like. So, yeah, I got smacked on the head. I got, you know, ribs broken again and, you know, that sort of stuff. I was hung over a door and all sorts of things.
Oh, my God.
The second tier of militia, they were all right. They just did the job that they were told to do. They didn't really interact with us, but they let us go to the toilet. They put us back on the chains. They give us the food, that sort of thing. They were okay. And then you have the senior ranks, like the officers. And they would engage and they'd play games and that sort of thing because they got bored too, right? You know.
Oh, okay.
Some of them wanted to learn English, but the only English books they could get were Shakespeare. I don't know if you've ever read Shakespeare. I mean, I can barely understand it myself.
It's very hard to understand.
Teach someone to speak English from a Shakespeare book is really quite tricky. But, you know, it was interesting. They got me books on Islam from Iran and things like that. So it was interesting to read it, but... you know, I wasn't about to convert or anything like that.
Right. So. Well, when you're having, when you're locked up, I mean, you gotta have something to do, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the last year, I had a TV and all that sort of stuff to myself. It was great.
Oh wow. So the last year, you said you were treated a lot better than the first year and a half.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my final year was actually quite nice. I had an ensuite toilet. I was out of the chains. I could exercise. Didn't handcuff or blindfold me unless we were moving. You know, food was good. I was in a large room. The Iraqis used to sit in the room with me. We used to watch TV and things like that. Annoyingly, their favorite program was Prison Break. that kind of irritated me.
Oh, wow.
But hey-ho, you know, that's the way it goes.
How often would you say that you would get overly stressed or I would say depressed, like missing your family, your friends, and stuff like that? Was it like
I think that feeling never went away, and certainly the fear of being killed every day that you live, you know, thinking this could be your last day was quite stressful. What I was concerned about, and I said this to one of the militia commanders, that if you're going to kill me, just kill me. Don't keep me alive for 4 or 5 years and then kill me. You know what I mean?
Oh wow, yeah.
But he said that they weren't going to do it, although I didn't really believe him. You know, ultimately, they didn't kill me.
Did you ever kind of let your guard down a little bit as far as, like, what you were actually in, what situation you were in? Or was it always kind of like a very, you know, stressful, you know, like it was always in the back of your mind, never let your guard down at all?
No, I mean, I would say I never let my guard down. I mean, there were some funny moments, you know, things happen to us both, you know, we'd misinterpret each other or trip up or something. You know, there were funny moments, but I wouldn't exactly say it was, Joker Minute or anything like that, you know.
Okay. Yeah. So now that you're in the free world, how long have you been about?
Yeah, so 10? I've been released just over 10 years
yeah, 10
now.
Years, 10 okay, years yeah.
So, yeah, time flies.
Right.
You know, feels like yesterday to me. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you I remember listening to somebody else who you were talking to, you started your own company. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I started a small non-profit company, primarily to develop virtual reality training simulations. And one of the things I've been doing is developing a hostage survival training simulation. So, you know, when people when companies send people to work in dangerous countries, like oil companies or something like that.
Right.
They go on this hostage survival training course, but it's quite expensive and quite difficult to arrange. It takes a lot of time. And so I've been developing a virtual reality hostage survival training simulation. It's still a prototype, but it works now. It, you know, you can put it on and use it and stuff right. like that. It needs a bit of tweaking mm-hmm. here and there, but it's principally there. And the good thing with coronavirus, with the lockdown, I've been able to really develop it a lot more now.
Right.
So, yeah. So my next stage is to try and get funding to really push that out somewhere.
Actually, brings me up to a question I had. Have you, I guess in a sense, like, have you had a book or any type of deal like that, where you can actually give financing?
No. I've written a book, but that was because when I was a hostage, before I was a hostage, someone said I should write an autobiography mm-hmm. about my life. But I thought my life was quite boring. Oh, but when I was a hostage, I planned the autobiography. Right. So when I got out, I wrote it, but I've never done anything with it. I did extract the chapter on being held hostage and sort of expanded that into like an essay, I guess.
Right.
And I did create a book plan, but again, I never did anything with it.
Because I think your story kind of seems to me, I don't know if you guys have had that over there, but well, it should be on Netflix or that TV show where it's Locked Up Abroad.
It kind of... I did a Reddit thing some years back.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone said you should contact these people at Banged Up Abroad. I did contact them about it, but I forget what they said. They said something like we were focusing on Americans or something like that at the time. So I just, yeah, okay, whatever, you know. but I do talks. I predominantly do talks for companies, you know, that are sending people over to overseas. Mm-hmm. But I don't do that. But, you know, it's not my main career. You know what I mean? I still work in computing, right? So, you know, my career is computing. So I do talks, I don't know, once every 3-4 months, something like that.
Right.
But it's usually very closed audience. It's not, I don't do like public stuff.
Yeah, I think it's still it's a very good thing that you do. I mean, you never really know who you can possibly help, you know what I mean? Just because you've actually been through the actual, you've actually been in hostage situations. So somebody who hasn't can teach you all this and that, but at the end of the day, you know, one little thing or two that can help the person avoid that.
Yeah, indeed. No, for sure. I mean, they do exist, these sort of courses, but they're very niche,
right?
And very limited. You know, you like yourself. You know, as a podcaster, it's highly unlikely you would go on one of these courses. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Unless I do a podcast overseas.
Well, that's true, and maybe Michigan's really dangerous. I don't know.
Well, right. Well, it depends on really where you go. So.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Well, yeah,
but it's just like any place, any place where you're, you know, if you're in the wrong neighborhood, and you know, you shouldn't be there.
No, that's true. I remember riding through Michigan. It was quite nice. I can't remember when I did it, but I remember there was this huge side wind on the interstate, and. You know, I was leaning left, steering left on this motorcycle, and I'm still being blown to the right. You know, I had to pull over and stop, sort of thing, in the middle of nowhere. But wait about an hour. Anyway, yeah.
So you say you've been, you know, just to wrap it up a little bit, you've been to the U.S. and you say you've been to all the states.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things I did while I was a hostage, I planned a motorcycle trip, and. So when I got out, I flew to, you know, this is a couple of years after I got out. I flew to Tennessee, where one of my friends lives there,
mm-hmm.
and I bought a motorcycle using their address, which is great. And yeah, I rode the motorcycle across to all 48 states. I flew to Hawaii and took a cruise ship to Alaska. So that was pretty cool. Did that for a couple of years. That was great. Beat working, because obviously while I was a hostage, I was getting all my salary. And you don't pay rent as a hostage. I don't know if you know, but you don't pay rent. It's great. So yeah. I really enjoyed that. That was a good stress reliever, really.
So you were actually getting paid until the company got bought out, or even after the company got bought out?
No, even after the company got bought out. And not only that, but when I got released, it turned out, you know, when I started the job, I was like, you know, junior insignificant programming pleb. by the time I got released as a hostage, I was like a senior managing team leader or something. I got promotions, pay rises, holiday pay, danger pay, all sorts of stuff.
Oh my God, that's a little ironic or funny, but in a good way.
I mean, can you imagine the assessment every year? You know,
right.
Peter Moore, oh yeah, he's still alive. Give him a pay rise. You
know? Right. I wonder if to a certain degree, like if you were to not have those, I guess, the live proofs, would you still be having a job, or would they just totally give up on you?
No, I think they still would have carried on. From what I could gather, the proof of life videos were more for the press and family and things like that. The British Embassy was always in communication with a negotiator, you know, with this militia. So they had a pretty good grip on who was alive and who wasn't and that sort of thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, Peter, I can talk to you for a long time, but I know it's getting pretty late over there in your in England. So thank you so much for coming on. Do you have any final words that you want to say?
I think, you know, what happened to me was very extreme, but I think the bottom line is, look, bad things happen to people in life, but that doesn't mean you've got to give up on life.
Right.
You know, you can carry on and you will get through it, and you will go back to doing something good again. And just because it's something bad happens to you, it doesn't have to define you. It doesn't have to write your life off forever. And I think that's what I take away from this, you know?
Yeah, that's a great way to look at life. You know, especially like being through what you've been through, like, and still have a very optimistic all view of it. And even in the way you tell your story, you still say it in a very, you know, kind of funny, you know, the funny parts, so you're still able to pervade that message, you know.
I try to. I always say you can't take it too seriously, else you get depressed.
Yeah, that is very true. That is very true. Thank you again. And do you have anywhere that if anybody wants to look at your like social media and stuff like that?
Yeah. So if you look me up on Reddit, my username is BD504840.
Okay.
And the same with Twitter. You know, it was one of those things I created years ago that was a good idea. I just tell people it's my body dimensions.
You know, I was gonna ask you about that, because what I noticed is that a lot of your usernames are BD, you know, 05.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, yeah. It has meaning, but it's kind of been lost in history. So we'll just leave it as my body dimensions.
So yeah, so guys, if you guys want to go check them out on Reddit or Twitter. Again, it's going to be, what is it again?
BD504840.
All right. Thank you again, Peter.
Brilliant. Thanks for your time. Yep. I appreciate it.
Yep. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to wrap it up for tonight. If you like this episode, don't forget to go to Smith Podcast on Instagram and go and follow us there. If you're on Apple Podcasts, leave a review, comment. I know this is our first episode, or my first episode, so definitely got a lot to improve on, but definitely had fun talking to the gentleman. He's definitely a person who's been through a lot and is still able to have a humorous side to him. I have nothing but respect for the gentleman. Again, it's Smit Podcast on Instagram. That is SMIT Podcast. Have a good night. Peace.